And joining us now on PMP Network is Tim Reed. Tim has written a book called Tim and Tom with Tom Dreesen, who we've heard from already. And Tim has been on the show before. Of course, we all know him and love him from shows like Frank's Place and the WKRP in Cincinnati and one my kids love, Sister Sister. But the book is not really about that. That's the good part. The interesting part of Tim's life is his life itself. And as kind of Tom said, the first part of your life was a little bit different than the second part.
Oh, yeah, yeah. First part, well, I guess, you know, very different and very difficult, but I guess that's what made the second part possible. I survived the first part.
Well, that's also what made you possible, because without all these ingredients, you wouldn't be what you are.
That's correct.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit about life when you started out. The book starts pretty much with your mom walking into a church and confronting your father when she was pregnant. He was married to somebody else.
Yes.
That was the beginning of your life.
Yeah, that was. I came into the world in a very tumultuous times. World War II was in rare form, and you know, the world was much, much different than it is now. And I was born into a situation where being a bastard child and a single mom and difficult times and rationing and difficulty in living and poverty and the struggle. So I was born into struggle and barely survived birth and had a very difficult childhood, like many people did it who were born in that time. So it was with relief that things began to flatten out about the time I started spending some regular time in school. As I've grown up to be, I am I'm very much a cheerleader for education, that's for sure, because it really not only gives you the information that you need to maneuver in the world, but it also gives you some time away from the struggle, you know. I was a kid that just survived and was able to and lucky enough, and then found myself in show business. And from then on, thinking the struggle would ease, it didn't. It actually intensified, but a different kind of struggle nonetheless.
I was telling Tom that I thought that, you know, it's kind of a fairy tale story, both of you folks, in terms of the success you've enjoyed. But on the other hand, wouldn't it have been a fairy tale ending for this book if it was the success you guys got as a team rather than individuals?
Yeah, it would have. I mean, that was the dream. I mean, that was the intent. But fate didn't seem to have that in the cards for us. It was no matter how difficult. I mean, how hard we tried, it just we never were embraced by the industry, by the business. The people liked us, but the industry just seemed to say, no, we don't want this. This is not what we are interested in.
The interesting thing that comes across in the book is that while you were together, there were ups and downs, but there were times where it looked like you were going to go over the mountaintop, and then something always pulled back at the last second. Something happened.
Yeah. It was. We were a heartbeat away from major stardom. We did national television shows. We traveled all over America, and club you could think of, and every possible venue. But every time we got close, it seems like something in the industry, someone or something would say no or avoid answering the question or putting any energy behind it, like they have so many acts. I hear of so many young comics today talk about how people like Bernie Brillstein or whoever it was, these great managers of comedy, people who were so much behind building the careers of so many people, just took them and shaped them and all that. We never got taken in by the industry.
Mm. That's true. In fact, they didn't know what to do with you folks.
They did not know what to do with us. We were a paradox. We the country, of course, didn't know what, and still doesn't know what to do with race. We are people who hide in the shadows of reality. I mean, Hollywood is very good for yelling liberalism for everything, but when you look at what comes out of Hollywood, it's no different than what people feel and respond to every day racially in this country. I mean, Hollywood is an illusion.
Well, there is an African American running for president right now, and a Democratic candidate, which is pretty interesting in terms of the history of this country.
It's interesting, very interesting. I didn't think I'd see it in my lifetime. However, that being said, the structure of how it is and what it will depend on comes back to race. You know, it comes back to what people say and what people will do once they're behind the curtain. What will take over in their inner consciousness? Will they live in the shadows of the past, or will they step into the bright future of tomorrow? I mean, that's the decision everybody has to make. And that's when race does pay an interest, because it really, as much as we avoid saying it doesn't, it really does. I mean, in fact, you said, we got a black man running. Well, if you were any other color, you wouldn't say that.
Well, I mean, it's obvious, but on the other hand, we also have a very liberal guy running against a conservative, and maybe people would be uncomfortable with someone who's so liberal as well.
I doubt it. I think the final thing will come down to race. I just believe it will. I guess I'm an old school guy, and I think eventually it will come down to that. It always does, and I don't see any miraculous thing happening in the world today. It may not be called race, but eventually I think it's what it'll fall down to. In the difference in what happened when this was around before, back when I was a youth and getting involved in politics on a big level for the first time, when Robert Kennedy was running, and I was very involved in that campaign as a young, eager person to see change in the world, something happened, and that is my group. We lost focus. We got caught up in the drug culture, the sexual revolution, Vietnam protests, and we lost focus on our purpose. And because of that, a few generations have suffered. I'm wondering this time if young people who really hold the sway of the vote, if they will get involved in the propaganda machines and get caught up in race, or will they stay focused on true changing the world? I mean, that's really the way it boils down. We're going to vote the way we always have. I don't see this being a vote pivotal by people, the adults. I think the new young voters and the young people who are emotionally involved in this campaign the way they were before back in '68 will determine the outcome of this vote, and who knows how they're going to do.
Do you have any feeling about a woman actually on the ticket as well?
No, I have no. I have. You know, it's not about gender. It's really not about gender. It's really not. It's really about the people. It's not about the candidates. It's really about what America wants. It's not about the candidate. The candidates are a product of what we have asked for, but the true nature has nothing to do whether it's a woman or whether it's going to be a black man or the past and McCain. I mean, whatever it's going to be. I'm a registered independent, so I'm not a party affiliate. I don't preach party. I preach individual, and I think it's going to be determined again by young people. I don't think the fact that a woman is running will weigh that much with the young people.
No. If the young people get out and vote, then Obama's going to win overwhelmingly.
I don't know. I mean, I know it will be different. If they vote, if the young people vote, it'll be a change. There will be a change, a tremendous change, because not only will Republicans also will have to say, okay, things are changing, these young people, because they've always been taken for granted, though, that they talk, but they don't vote. This time, if they vote, things will change. If they don't vote, it'll take another 50 to 100 years before this opportunity comes around again.
I agree with you in terms of, because the youth, they have to energize the program. Otherwise, it just stays the same. And if they don't, then it stays the same.
It's going to be their problems. I'll be, you know, getting my Social Security and hope they have nice jobs so they can pay for me.
Exactly. You know, reading the book, it's an amazing struggle. I mean, this was the stuff that kind of impacted me when I was reading it. The fact that you didn't know who your real father was till you were 9. And by the way, you had that in common with Tom.
Yeah.
He didn't know until he was older, too, who his real father was. And the other thing seems to be something that still is big is that people who don't have the love, family, the whole thing at home, they go out and try to find it. And you tried to find it initially with the Corner Boys. The gang around your group. Tell us a little bit about that, and for some of the kids listening out there, your experiences with gangs and what do you think about them now?
Well, first of all, a big difference in the kind of violence and the kind of peer pressure that I faced as opposed to what young people are facing now. I mean, we didn't have the kind of firepower and the kind of, what is the word? I guess immoral, in a sense, the kind of violence that these young people tout and are proud of were back then still beyond our imagination. I mean, we were certainly young people were violent in the context of the time, But very rarely did anyone have a gun. And if it's so, it was a handmade gun, a zip gun or whatever, and it did more damage to someone trying to take it and pull it back and fire it than wherever it would go. But we were destructive to the community in context, and we were destructive to ourselves. And I think that, like many young people, you know, who are out struggling, trying to survive and find a place to belong, the local gangs offered an opportunity for some of them and people like myself to flirt with belonging. Quite easily, I found, and quite quickly, I found that the dangers outweighed the advantages of being, you know, when someone put a German Luger to my head and cocked the trigger, I knew right then, this was not something that led to longevity.
Mm-hmm.
And it didn't take much for me to get out of it, but at that point. But there's a sociopathic behavior now that's beyond what we were doing. Young people today really have to start very early figuring out for themselves how they're going to survive. And you know, and there's this materialistic sort of push that we have today, not only for young people, for adults, is far greater than it was for me. I mean, all we wanted were maybe a pair of, I don't know what it was, but it wasn't the kind of economic desires that these young people have. And these young people very early want things that cost thousands and thousands of dollars. Well, how do you get that?
Yep, there's only one way.
Yeah.
If you don't have a legitimate way to get it, you get it illegitimately. Yeah,
yeah, but we didn't have those. I talked to as many young people as I can to give them my information in terms of what happened to me. But the context is it's so different now, and it's hard to keep taking the old theories and applying to today. We have to come up with new ways of dealing with this. So telling a young person to act the way I did won't mean much. I've got to come up and join them and try to create new solutions. And that's what I mean by change. And it's going to take young people first demanding it and fighting for it like we attempted to do in the 60s. Of course, we lost focus. And I just hope that they are stronger than we were. We let them down. And I hope that these young people today don't let down the generations that's going to follow them.
Your actual father, William Lee Reed, owned something called the Swing Inn, which was a big deal when you were growing up.
Well, actually, he owned the Commodore. Swing Inn was across the street.
Oh, okay. Oh, the Swing Inn's the one that ruined him, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't want to I'd really confuse him, but the my point that I was trying to make is that he was really a victim of something pretty nasty, and you kind of witnessed that. It must have been very, very painful, not only for him, because you say in the book that pretty much that killed him.
Yes,
yeah, but
it took a few years to hang on, but that killed him.
What did it do to you?
Well, you know, it's interesting. It drove me to college. I looked at what destroyed my father and what destroyed his business, and I realized it was a couple simple things. One was a $5 dance license, and the other was not really having. My father never finished high school. He got his GED later on, and he's a very, very intuitively smart man, and very good with his hands, and he was, you know, was a leader, a civic leader, self-educated in a way. But he didn't have that basic understanding of things that could have helped him a little bit. And I said to myself, then I'm going to college and get me a business degree. This will never happen to me. And I went to college that following summer and majored in business administration with a minor in economics. And it was because of that. And it also breeded a lot of anger, but I already had a lot of anger because I'd come through the civil rights movement. I'd been very active in that. And so how do you take that hostility, that anger, and vent it? And so I chose to try to better my life with it and get back a different way.
What was your first break in acting?
First break in acting was, it was about after Tom and I broke up. I came to Hollywood, and I was fortunate enough to get a job thanks to Clifton Davis on That's My Mama.
Hmm.
That was my first television show. I played sort of a young Jesse Jackson kind of character on That's My Mama. And that was in 75, I believe, late 75. And then I just started doing bit parts and a lot of pilots and until I got WKRP in Cincinnati.
Now, in 75, I believe, was the same year that Tom went on The Tonight Show, right?
Yeah, it was a little after that. Yeah.
Tom, yeah. What did that feel like to sit and watch him on TV?
Well, I explained in the book. It was painful. It was one of the most painfully exhilarating experiences I think I can remember having in quite some time. Because first of all, I'm happy for Tom. I mean, there was, you know, I learned early just because someone else is successful doesn't mean you're not. But what I did feel was I wanted it to be me. Not that I didn't want him to have it. I'm thinking like that should be me too, you know. And I'm sitting there in the depths of poverty at the time. I mean, I didn't have anything going. I hadn't worked in quite some time. And I'm sitting there and I'm thinking, and I knew that it was going to launch him. I knew it. He was so good. It was just watching those moments on The Tonight Show when you could watch a young comic or somebody and you knew they were going to take off. I remember Bette Midler on the first time. And you just knew these people were going to become successful.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew it. And I was thinking, he's gone. And I'm thinking, what am I going to do? So it was really an interesting experience.
But at the time, if I remember correctly, reading the book here, you were living with a very famous woman.
Yeah, I had lived, you know, in the book. Well, a lot of people, there's been a lot said about that, even before the book. But it wasn't as long. Was and still is a very good friend of mine, Delarice. She was a very good friend of mine. And we had a brief romantic situation for about 10 months. But in that time, she really gave me some solace. I mean, she taught me a lot about the business. I probably learned more about the peripheral of the business from her than I have from anyone in the whole 40 years I've been in the business. And so I was fortunate enough to have shelter for about 10 months while we were there. But I realized, of course, and she realized that on the romantic side, it wasn't a great future in that. But the friendship was the thing that that's what started. I mean, we had been friends a year or so before that. So it wasn't like, and people think it was like this 2 or 3 year romantic involvement, but it wasn't. We were friends before and after. It was a brief few months of romance.
But you found yourself in the Hollywood lights at that point, too.
Yeah, well, thanks to her, she wanted what it started as a friend. She said, you know, when there was an event, she said, come go. You need to see and meet these people. So through her, I met some of the biggest names in show business, Sammy Davis and Sidney Poitier and Colin McRae. And I was meeting these people and sitting in with them. I met Cubby Broccoli, who had just finished one of the James Bond movies, and all these people. And I'm sitting in the room listening, and it was both exciting and also painful, because any one of these people in the room could have changed my life, my career. But you couldn't say, I mean, I've been taught to have a little class. You couldn't say, you know, hey, give me a job. You had to kind of, at least I chose, I won't say you have to. Some would have probably handled a lot better than I did. But I chose to keep it inward and just kind of be there and through osmosis pick up as much as I could about the business. I never did ask anybody for a job or, you know, maybe I should have on a few occasions, but I didn't.
You mentioned KRP, and of course that's where you became famous in America as Venus Flytrap and got all kinds of accolades. This is a very interesting part of the book that you wrote here. You mentioned that when it was canceled, you had just begun to get some notice. You did a movie, You Can't Take It With You, with Gene Stapleton and Barry Bostwick and Blythe Danner. And this is the quote that you wrote here. I kept getting calls to parades, Easter parade, Thanksgiving parade, Rose Bowl parade. I was the black guy they liked pulling out there. That's when I started, and then you said that after that it was over, it ended, and that's when you started learning some big lessons. What were some of those lessons you were learning then?
Well, one lesson you learn is that, you know, it can be over as quickly as it started. Nothing lasts forever. And I was riding high and the network Golden Boy for a while. But I was also living above at the current means of what I was making this weekly salary, doing very well. I wouldn't make a lot of money compared to today's television personality. But back then, for me, I mean, I was making more money than I'd ever dreamed of. And when it was over, we forget that those bills and those debts and that lifestyle continues until you can get control of it, but that money doesn't. And I found myself way out there on the edge thinking, uh-oh, if I'm not careful, and do something right away, I'm not only going to be in trouble, I'm going to be back where I started. So you have to really prepare yourself for the career. You know, most people think the career is a sprint. A career isn't a sprint. It's a marathon, and one has to prepare themselves for the next thing. And at that time, I hadn't prepared myself as much as I learned. I had no one had told me about that part of it, so I had to do a quick survival training method to survive the lean years till something else came along. And then I was very fortunate. Something else did come along, and then something else. And I've done quite a few television series. I know for a fact that I've done more television series than any living actor in television today. I've done about 16 television series over my 40-year career.
And one of the ones that didn't do incredibly well in the ratings, but was one of the best shows I ever saw, was Frank's Place. I remember the show, and in fact, there was a young guy in that cast. He was kind of a bodybuilder type. That came on our show. We had him actually in studio at the time.
Don Yeso?
Yeah, exactly. Wasn't a great guy.
Yeah, Don was a wonderful guy. He was a gym teacher at the time we discovered him on his way to New Orleans to go home. And we picked him on the, Hugh met him on the plane and came back and said, I found Shorty. And the reason we picked him is because he spoke with that dialect, that very distinctive New Orleans dialect. You think they're from Brooklyn, but they aren't. They're from New Orleans. It's just a slight difference between a Brooklyn accent and a New Orleans accent. And he had it. And matter of fact, he had it so well at times on the show, we used to use subtitles.
And of course, your wife worked on the show as well.
Yes, she played an embalmer.
How long have you folks been married now?
25 years.
Wow. Well, a lot of congratulations on that.
Yeah, well, that's an achievement. It's about 89, 90.
That's an achievement in itself. You know? And it's interesting, you talked about youth before. I have a couple of teenagers, and they're familiar with you because of Sister.
Yeah. I've been very blessed. I'm, you know, no matter what, from this point on, I can't argue or squabble. One of my great pleasures show business pleasures happened about a couple years, maybe 4 years ago. I was somewhere doing something, and a man walked up to me with his son. And he said, my son would like to have your autograph. He's a fan of Sister. So I start signing the autograph. And the guy chuckled to himself. He said, you know, this is kind of amazing. I said, what? He said, well, when I was my son age, my father brought me over to you to get an autograph for WKRP in Cincinnati. And I thought, wow, that's kind of neat.
You should ask him if he still had it. That would be my first question. Where is it?
Well, they never keep these things there. I often wonder what people do with them.
Yeah, I was going to say, you better take care of that. I don't want to see that on eBay. What is it like now with the internet and the tabloids and all these things? Are now it's completely different than when you first started out, when it was just a few networks and things like that.
Yeah.
What's it like now in terms of the way you have to live when you have to watch out for cameras all over the place?
Well, I don't particularly care about too much. I mean, where I lived and what I've come up with, this is a cakewalk. But I tell you though that what does trouble me is that. We have become politically correct to the point where America is becoming humorless, and we are so politically correct. I mean, the kind of stuff that Tom and I did on the stage back in the early 70s, late 60s, early 70s, if we did it today and someone had a cell phone and they videoed it, put it on YouTube, we'd be run out of town. I think we've become so politically correct that we've lost sight of the basis and the whole point of humor. Humor comes out of conflict. And we don't want conflict. We want the illusion that there is no conflict, that everything is you know, we all walk off hand in hand. But I'm very much concerned that who are the real celebrities today? Are the pundits on these political shows? Who are the celebrities? I mean, who's running for office here? I sometimes think that these news people are. Everybody's got an opinion about anything, but nobody questions the people who are giving the opinion. I'd like to know what qualifies these people. What did they do? Have they ever run for office? Have they ever run a business? Have they ever done anything worthy of all of the diatribe that they're spitting out about what they think? Who cares what they think? You know, and I think that that's what it is happening with the internet. We have so much opinion based on very little fact, just emotions and instinct, and yet people are just digesting it from every point of view. And I think enough. I mean, I think we need a little more humor in life and a little less anger and hostility in our humor. I mean, comics today are, most of them are angry. Comics today, I look at them and I'm going, why is that person so angry?
Hmm.
You know?
Well, Yeah. Well, you know, the interesting thing is that you're actually correct, whether it's, you know, Keith Olbermann or Bill O'Reilly, you know, these people that are always screaming, yelling and screaming. And one of the things that it's caused in the country, from what I can see, is there's a big schism in this country. And in Rodney King's old expression, why can't we all get along? It seems like there's a battle brewing instead of everybody working together.
It's not only a battle. I think it's one that we are not paying attention to, and the one that's going to determine all of our fates, and that is, the battle is not going to be between black and white. It's not going to be between anything but young and old. And that young and old will be defined at about, you know, 30-something years old. Anybody who is going to be faced with running the country, the commissioner of this, the mayor of this, the city councilman of this, are going to be young. What are they saying? How many millions of people are going to be over the age of 60 in the next 10 to 15 years? Well, they're going to want to retire, and they're going to be getting their Social Security. They want to get what they think the country owes them, and yet the young people have to distribute it. And if we don't come together and start helping these young people govern and giving them the information, some of the information, or sharing some of the information, we're leaving it up to them, and they're going to be angry. So I see more of a battle between young and old being defined by the government as opposed to by one's personal life. Being a real battle. I mean, this age thing between these young people, we need to, and all I see on the television, these pundits are all these old guys talking about, and they're all wealthy. I mean, I don't think there's anybody on television running their mouth who doesn't make at least $250,000 to $300,000 to $400,000 a year. I mean, that's what they get paid to be on these shows. And yet, you know, the rest of the country who's following this stuff are going to have to fight the battle.
Hmm.
And I see a big problem with that. I don't know, race is, believe me, race is literally dying out. I mean, I look at the kids today. They're multiracial. They think differently. They have their own issues, and race is not one of them, except for the old hearts that are being, you know, programmed by the adults. It's like a perfect example and we kind of talk about it, and I get back to the book. We kind of talk about this in the book in a way. We are historic not because of who we were. Because we came about at a time when the country was just unbelievably different than it is now. There was complete chaos and intensity in America, unlike we have seen until what's coming now. And here we are trying to make people laugh, you know, getting beat up on the stage, chased out of town. But we kept doing it. We kept doing it. And thank God we've survived and we've made it. So there's an inspiration in the book as well as the hard times. There's a certain amount of inspiration that I feel, a compelling story of two people against the odds. And when I look at the world today, I think, oh, my goodness, more people have got to take this struggle on. More people have got to get involved and stop allowing other people to lead them in their thought patterns, you know. And that's what I see missing, is that we're sitting back and we you know, whoever's hot. 3 weeks ago, no one ever heard of the name. Well, no one. I would say most of America, 99% of America, never heard of the word Palin. And now they're dolls. She's the most popular figure in all of celebrityhood. And we're all going to feel one way about her, either we like her or dislike her. And it happened so fast. Well, how did it happen so fast? The media.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Well, yeah.
And so we're caught up in the media. We're being led to our opinion as opposed to let's learn about this person. Let's do our homework. Let's not be, you know, led to the trough. Let's walk.
Well, I think the media anointed Barack Obama as well.
Yeah, but at least it 18 months. We know. I don't think there's much we don't know about him.
Well, who knows? But yeah, they certainly did anoint him. They're not anointing her though. They're kind of whacking her in the head. But they've made her famous though.
The press has got anointed her. Believe me. I mean, they're gonna, because they always do. They always anoint you, then they whack at you. But I'm saying they have pushed her faster than any celebrity in a long, long time. I don't think anybody has come out of nowhere in 2 weeks from and being as popular. She's the most popular figure in America today, and it's just been 2 weeks. I find that a bit frightening and also kind of interesting and intriguing. I mean, not against her. I don't know.
Yeah, no, I understand what you're saying.
Yeah, I haven't formed any opinion about her. I'm just saying that the act of her becoming so popular in such a short amount of time.
This book, again, is called Tim and Tom, an American Comedy in Black and White. It's from the University of Chicago Press. It is, in my estimation, a kind of a wonderful fairy tale, but it's real, of going from American nightmare to American dream. And it's a great story for people to read because it's inspirational and it's real.
Thank you. I appreciate it. And anybody who wants to find out what's going on with Tim and Tom, we have a wonderful webpage up called timandtomcomedy.com. That's Tim and Tom Comedy. They can find out our schedule. We're going to go on a tour starting next week in Chicago where we begin our career. And we'll be on the road for the next few months promoting the book and out there talking about certain elements of the book.
Well, we're going to post a link to timandtomcomedy.com, and we'll wish you a lot of luck on your tour and everything else. It was great to talk to you again.
All right, then. Nice talking to you.
Take care.